This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents The High Council, Book 6 of the Royal Institute of Magic, written by Victor Kloss, performed by Peter Kenny. Chapter 1. The Queen's Final Warning. Date, 27th of March, 1603.
The Queen is dying and you're late, Lord Samuel said. I hope there is a good explanation for your ill-timed absence.
There is, Michael Greenwood said, without elaborating. The lack of explanation turned Samuel's face a bright shade of red, which gave Michael a little pleasure, an emotion in short supply at the moment. All five founding directors were present in the hallway of the executive floor of the Royal Institute of Magic, each showing various degrees of anxiety. Lord Samuel commanded a large chair and was constantly flicking his beady eyes at the throne room door. The scholar and diplomacy directors looked no less nervous, sitting on a gold-plated chaise longue, hands plastered firmly on thighs. Only Charlotte, trade director, showed any calm, which Michael admired. She strode up and down the hallway, heedless of Samuel's nasty looks. Michael chose to lean against the wall, at a respectable distance from the throne room.
"What are the doctors saying?" he asked.
"An hour, at the most," Charlotte said. "Under her orders we have faked her death in London and brought her here. She has instructions for each of us."
"We just need those blasted doctors to let us in," Lord Samuel said. "I'm starting to wonder if they're stopping us on purpose."
"Don't be ridiculous, Samuel," Charlotte said.
She was still pacing the room, her petite green dress swishing to and fro.
They will let us in when she is ready.
But she wasn't ready for another half an hour, and by that time, even Michael was starting to fidget, clenching and relaxing his hands. Samuel had escalated his mutterings to unpleasant remarks about the doctors and anyone else who happened to cross his mind. Charlotte had stopped and started her pacing half a dozen times whenever there was a hint of noise from the throne room. Michael was beginning to wonder how much longer the Queen's health would hold, when the door finally opened, and an immaculately dressed guard appeared, a spell shooter upon his waist.
"Lord Samuel, would you come through, please? Her Majesty is waiting."
Samuel dabbed his forehead and cheeks with his now damp handkerchief and hauled himself to his feet with a strength that defied his weight. He passed through, and the guard promptly shut the door. There was a group intake of breath as the four directors watched him leave.
"What could the Queen have to say in her final hour?" Sophia, the scholar director, wondered, staring wide-eyed at the locked door.
"Plenty, I would imagine," Charlotte said. "My concern is that she is lucid enough to say it. She's died once already. It's only powerful magic that's keeping her alive."
"She'll be lucid," Michael said. "Of that you can be sure."
Sophia nodded, but didn't appear convinced, and went back to staring at the door, her hands pinching her dress. Charlotte had taken the seat Samuel had occupied, so Michael took the role of pacing the hallway slowly. He cast his mind back to the last time all the directors were together, waiting upon the Queen. Back then she had given them specific instructions on what to do with her armour, and Michael had no doubt that her orders would be no less significant this time. The wait for Samuel to return seemed to drag out endlessly, and had them jumping at even the smallest sound from the door. Michael was semi-occupied counting the exact steps between each of his journeys back and forth down the hallway when he heard the door open. Lord Samuel emerged, looking thoughtful, his eyes focused on the floor. Michael tried to read his expression and was surprised when Samuel stopped next to him and gave him an appraising look.
"When you are done, we need to talk," Samuel said,
his voice brokering no doubt upon the matter. Michael was caught by Samuel's unusual sincerity and only managed a nod before the warden director disappeared down the hallway.
"Charlotte Rowe," the guard called.
Charlotte bit her lip and, despite the nervous wait, strode with determination into the throne room, where the guard promptly shut the door again, leaving just three of them. To Michael's surprise, Charlotte took almost as long as Lord Samuel and emerged some 20 minutes later looking quite emotional. She stopped just as she was about to pass Michael and put a hand on his arm. Her steely grey eyes looked moist.
She's a remarkable woman,
Charlotte said, her voice soft, almost distant.
Listen carefully to what she has to say. I have a feeling your message will be the most significant.
I will, Michael assured her, even as Sophia was called upon and passed inside. The remaining two directors took less than 10 minutes, and both looked just as emotional as Charlotte upon their departure. Michael expected to be ushered right in, but it took an unusually long time before the guard emerged for the final time.
Director Greenwood, Her Majesty is ready.
Michael was expecting Queen Elizabeth to be lying on her deathbed, surrounded by some of the best Institute healers, salvaging the last few moments of her life. What he saw was entirely different. Queen Elizabeth sat on a gilded chair at the center of the spacious, exquisitely furnished throne room. There were a couple of Institute healers, either side of the room, he recognized, and they gave him an appropriately respectful nod, befitting his position. But they made no move to fuss over the Queen, nor did it seem like she required it. Michael bowed, and the Queen beckoned him forwards. There was a small desk in front of her, piled with several scrolls and documents. On the other side was a chair, which Michael sat down on.
"This brings back some memories," Queen Elizabeth said with a subtle smile. "Though, if I remember correctly, you were standing last time we had a discussion of this significance."
"I don't recall a chair being present," Michael said, with a straight face. Coming from anyone else, Michael's comment might have been considered inappropriate, but the Queen only gave another smile. Now that he was this close, Michael could more clearly see the genuine state of the commander. Her skin was pale and plastered tightly against her face. Her eyes, as strong as ever, were deathly tired, and Michael noticed with some alarm that the flecks of gold in her pupils had almost entirely taken over their usual brown complexion. She was at death's door, being held in the realm of the living by sheer willpower and considerable magic.
"My healers tell me I have less than 20 minutes, Elizabeth said. "And there is much to say, so it would be well to get started."
20 minutes? Michael said with alarm.
"Is there nothing else to be done?" "No. It is a miracle I'm alive. As it is, we have fooled my subjects, and my body will be rushed back to London the moment I pass."
She lifted a pockmarked hand.
"Now, there is some vital information I have withheld from everyone regarding the Unseen Kingdoms. I have been very careful to guard it. But you, Michael Greenwood, are about to become its custodian, if you are ready."
Michael felt his heart flicker, but he maintained a composed face.
"I am ready."
Despite Michael's agreement, the Queen gave him a long, hard look before continuing.
"Did you ever wonder how I came upon the Unseen Kingdoms in the first place? After all, they are not something one simply stumbles upon."
"I assumed you were approached by one of the kingdoms. Theron, most likely. They were always ambitious," Michael replied.
"No," the Queen said. "The Unseen Kingdoms never approached me."
Michael frowned.
"Who did then?"
"An emissary from the High Council," Queen Elizabeth said. "A grand sorcerer by the name of Laszlo Keep."
Michael found himself lost for words, which was just as well as the Queen wasn't finished.
"I was sailing across up the North Sea when Laszlo appeared quite suddenly upon deck. There was much disturbance upon the sailors, but frankly, none of them could touch a sorcerer of such power."
Michael was aware that the Queen's hands were shaking a little as the final minutes of her life were quickly ebbing by.
"What is the High Council?"
"A brotherhood of 24 of the most powerful and dangerous sorcerers in the Unseen Kingdoms. They represent every race. Their knowledge and skill in the science of magic is unparalleled. Of course, this was the first time I had encountered magic of any sort, but it did not take long to realize that I had stumbled upon something very unusual."
"What did they want?" Michael asked, his voice now almost a whisper.
"Nothing," the Queen said. "But they imparted wisdom of the Unseen Kingdoms, and told me of the land and riches that could be mine. They would, they promised, give me access to these kingdoms. Michael frowned. Something didn't feel right.
Why would they do that? Queen Elizabeth gave an unhealthy cough, and Michael spotted a little blood, but he knew better than to rush to her aid.
A growing threat, Elizabeth said after a moment. They warned me that in time a powerful enemy, one that cannot be overestimated, would come forth, and that it would be my responsibility to withstand that enemy. They felt that my empire had the best chance of doing so.
Michael's attention immediately went to the Dark Elf King.
You think they were talking about Sakdar?
I do, Elizabeth said with a subtle nod. As Sakdar's army grew, he began to conquer several of the unseen kingdoms, and I was visited several more times by the High Council. Upon the eve of the great battle, where we eventually banished Sakdar from the land of the living, the High Mage, Lord of the Council, came to me himself with a gift. Can you guess what that gift was?
Michael's voice was so soft, he barely heard himself.
Elizabeth's armor. Your armor.
Despite the Queen's health, he stared at the table, littered with papers, and took several moments to compose himself.
I take it there is a point to this story, Michael said eventually.
The Queen nodded, her frail arms clasping the armchair once more.
The High Council. I do not trust them.
Michael had a great deal of respect for the Queen's intelligence, but that comment gave him a little start.
Why not? He asked. Surely they have been on our side from the very start.
Manipulation, Queen Elizabeth said. I know all about it, and it smells strongly within the High Council. Any group with that much power must be treated with caution.
The Queen gave a sudden spasm of her chest, but before Michael could move, one of the healers rushed forwards and fired a small white spell into her chest. She relaxed, but only a fraction, and Michael could see beads of sweat running down her forehead. Nevertheless, she remained upright and stared Michael right in the eye.
I have a job for you. Perhaps the most important of all, she said,
her voice somehow sounding clear, despite the pain that must have been racking her body.
Anything, of course, Your Majesty, Michael said.
The High Council, Elizabeth said. They will have some role to play, perhaps not now, but certainly at the end. It will be your responsibility to discover what that is and make sure it doesn't come back and haunt us all, which I fear it may do if left undiscovered.
I will make it a priority, Michael assured her.
The Queen gave a nod and then went into another fit of coughs. Again, the healer fired a spell into her chest, but this time it did very little, and Michael had the sudden urge to lean over and help. But the Queen spotted his intention and raised an arm.
I think it is time for you to go, Elizabeth said. I am almost done here.
Michael felt a rush of emotion that started at his head and rushed down through his body, making him flush. He stood up and then hesitated. Despite the pain and pressure of the occasion, the Queen gave him a rare, affectionate look.
I have enjoyed our company, Michael Greenwood. Be well, and good luck.
Michael smiled, though he couldn't find the right words in response. Instead, he turned, took in one last look at the commander of the Institute, and left the throne room, knowing he had just seen Queen Elizabeth for the last time. Chapter 2. Back to the Institute. Date. Present day.
Get down!
Ben yanked Charlie down as a searing purple flash sizzled the top of his short, frazzled hair. Where did that come from? Charlie asked, looking around in utter confusion.
Dark elves on steeds at 6 o'clock, Crowbeg said.
His leather dwarven face was stern, but the shining light in his eyes gave Ben the idea that he might be enjoying himself.
I can go back and remove them, Crowbeg offered.
Ben glanced behind and saw a half-dozen dark elves riding the most peculiar hind-based animals that reminded him of a certain particular meat-eating dinosaur. They were snapping and slashing their way through the London crowds towards Victoria Station. But to their credit, the London authorities were beginning to come to grips with the terror that was unfolding. The police and even the first signs of the military were beginning to materialize, slowing the dark elves.
No, let them go. We need to get out of here, Ben said.
Crowbeg gave the smallest glance of disappointment before following Ben and the others into Victoria Station, where they came to an almost complete standstill. Despite its size, with vast arches and huge floor space to provide for the 20 platforms, it was complete pandemonium. The calmer citizens were trying to come to terms with what was going on, but many had spotted the dark elves and were running in every direction. Not everyone was panicking. In typical London spirit, many braver souls were charging the dark elves that had broken into the station with anything they could get their hands on, from umbrellas to scalding cups of coffee. Several from both sides went down, and Ben's heart went out to them. He desperately wanted to join the fight, but instead forced himself towards the London Underground.
I feel terrible,
Abigail said, her large brown eyes eyeing the scene with despair.
Is there nothing we can do?
Not right now, Dagmar said. Ben is right. We need to get back to the Institute.
With some difficulty, Ben squeezed his way down the stairs into the underground, going against the majority of traffic, most of which was trying to get out. The poor souls probably not realizing that was where the real danger lay. He dived over the ticket barrier, as did Joshua, whereas Crowbeg just charged right through them, leaving a convenient path for the others. Ben flew down the first series of escalators until he saw a lift that, despite the chaos, went completely unused. Eyes glazed over it. Some even stopped for a moment to wonder at its presence before inevitably moving on. Ben slammed a hand on the downward button. It wasn't long before the lift opened with a soft ping. To Ben's surprise, he had to stand back, as a dozen Institute members, armed and ready, flew out and into the station, barely paying the slightest bit of attention to them. Several other members joined them inside, and within moments they were plummeting down into the depths of London at stomach-churning speeds. They emerged from the lift into a torch-lit tunnel and joined the other members, who were also in a hurry to get back to the Institute. After several twists and turns, the seven of them emerged into the Victoria Dragonway. Despite the urgency of the situation, Ben couldn't help pausing for just a second to admire the sight. The ceiling was impossibly high and had a faint curve, creating a dome-like effect. Thousands of twinkling lights shone down on a station that was both more modern and yet vastly older and grander than Croydon. There were dozens of platforms, and most of them were busy with dragons coming and going. Institute members, as well as other unseens, were busy trying to find what limited space they could. The guards and conductors were constantly whistling and barking orders, attempting to keep the dragons moving. With considerable, and sometimes unfriendly, shuffling and elbowing, including Charlie inadvertently bumping into a two-headed troll who almost threw him onto the track, they managed to squeeze onto a dragon and were soon speeding underground towards Tasia. If Ben thought it was mad in London, that was nothing compared to the scene that hit them as the dragon pulled up and came to a gentle stop sometime later. He only just about managed to stumble out of the carriage before being barged out of the way by a trio of dwarf wardens who entered the carriage, grim looks on their hairy faces.
Order!
A deep voice boomed. Another giant of a warden stood on a makeshift pedestal, four red diamonds floating above his right shoulder.
Keep in line, stay with your team leaders. Make sure you are travelling to the Dragonway you are assigned to. There are a dozen in London alone, remember?
Ben, followed by the others, scrambled their way through the station, up and over the bridge that crossed the platforms, and out onto the hill that led up to the Institute.
Oh my,
Natalie said. Even Dagmar stopped and stared, though only for a fraction of a second. The sky was swarming with steeds of every kind, almost completely blocking out the crisp morning sky. There must have been hundreds of small animals, Pegasi, eagles and griffins, manned by riders heralding from every corner of the unseen kingdoms. It was the bigger animals that caught Ben's eye, the huge wyverns, the flaming phoenixes and, of course, the dragons. They were present in every colour and size, often ridden by two or three experienced riders. Many of the beasts circled the sky, clearly under instructions not to mobilise yet, but others shot into the sky, heading for London.
"I need to go," Dagmar said, breaking the spell that had entranced them all. "The Institute will be expecting me."
Ben snapped out of his stupor.
"What, now?"
"Yes, now," Dagmar said, showing just a flicker of impatience behind her ordinarily unflustered face. Ben met her gaze with his own intensity.
"I need you back soon. We have several important decisions to make, and we can't wait. We need to have our own meeting."
For a moment, Ben thought Dagmar was going to override him, but instead she gave him a hard stare before nodding. Ben was again reminded that he was in charge. It was a daunting thought that made his stomach lurch.
"The Crimson Tower, 1 hour, Dagmar said.
"Won't that be busy?"
Joshua asked. "Surely the Institute will be using all secure locations for meetings."
"There are more secure locations than the Crimson Tower," Dagmar said. "The Institute itself is still the best place to hold meetings. I will make sure the tower is available. You just make sure you are there in an hour's time."
They watched Dagmar clomp her way up the hill until she was out of sight amongst the throngs of unseens.
"Now what?"
Charlie said, patting his stomach idly. Crowbeg clapped Charlie on the shoulder.
"An hour! Just enough time to have breakfast. I know a couple of places that wouldn't shut unless Suktar himself was battering down the door."
Crowbeg was right, and half an hour later they had tucked into a proper meal before Natalie led them towards the Crimson Tower. They weren't in any rush, and Ben was strangely reluctant to get there. Decisions that he knew he would soon have to make rolled around his head, and a few of them might result in fireworks. More than once, Ben caught Charlie staring at him, and he knew instinctively that his friend could guess some of those decisions. But it wasn't Charlie who Ben was worried about. It was Natalie. The sight of the Crimson Tower in the distance momentarily curtailed his thoughts. It was just as majestic as he remembered. Slender, with an elegant steeple that towered over the other buildings in West Taesia. The flickering shades of red on the exterior took his breath away and silenced all of them until they reached the tower's base.
"Anyone got a key?"
Charlie asked, shuffling his hands into deep pockets.
"Preferably one that will open a red magic tower."
"I have the key."
They all turned with surprise to see Dagmar striding down the street, her clumping footsteps drowned out for once by the constant noise coming from the skies above. Dagmar showed no distinguishable reaction from the meeting at the Institute, but that didn't stop Ben's curiosity being piqued. Had she met with the Executive Council? If so, he wondered what sort of plans they had made. More importantly, did she realise that those plans were meaningless compared to the ones they were about to make? Ben shook his head. He was getting ahead of himself, and he forced the thought aside as they entered the tower. Despite knowing how safe and secure the tower was, Ben wasn't the only one who entered a little hesitantly, as they immediately spotted the fire in the centre of the atrium, which burned just as brightly as their first visit, sending flames towering all the way to the steeple.
"I don't know why, but that fire scares me,"
Charlie said, his gaze going skywards.
"It would be nice if there was an off button."
"Without the flame of defence, the tower would be vulnerable," Dagmar said.
They took the spiral staircase up round the tower. At every landing, they came upon the familiar stone archway engraved with hieroglyphs and the big coloured eye at its top, providing yet more security. Ben hesitated only a moment before passing through. Even Charlie barely flinched. The solitary room in the tower was located at the very top. Once more, Dagmar produced a key, and they entered a large room, partitioned into two distinct sections, a formal meeting area, and a more relaxed lounging space with comfortable chairs and trays of finger foods placed on small coffee tables.
"Looks like the pixies have been here again,"
Crowbeg said, popping a cherry into his mouth. Ordinarily, Ben would have taken a moment to sample the finger food and perhaps help himself to a cup of tea. But this time, he went straight to the meeting table and sat down, closely followed by Dagmar. The rest followed, though Charlie and Crowbeg a little reluctantly, managing to stuff in a few more appetizers. Ben was suddenly aware that he sat at the head of the table, and everyone was looking at him with very contrasting expressions. Abigail and Crowbeg were the easiest to read, their simple, honest expressions clearly ready to listen to whatever Ben had to say. They, at least, would not be difficult in this meeting. Joshua wore a slightly guarded expression, but he too seemed willing to hear Ben speak. Dagmar was her usual self, but she had shown him enough support recently that he wasn't too worried about her, though he would be an idiot not to be wary. No, it was his two closest friends he was most concerned about, Charlie and Natalie. Charlie's curiosity and intelligence shone through, his eyes wide and his face a little flushed with anticipation. Natalie, on the other hand, looked far less at ease. She kept flicking her loose brown hair over her ears, her green eyes locked onto Ben. Ben knew exactly what was going through her head, but he had already decided he wasn't going to start there. He didn't want pandemonium from the beginning. Ben cleared his throat and took everyone in again. It was meeting time. Chapter 3. Hard Decisions.
"It's taken a while, but we're finally ready to hunt down Suktar," Ben said, addressing them all.
He felt momentarily like a schoolteacher. He had rarely, if ever, prepared for a speech, but this was a special occasion.
"Obviously, it's not going to be easy. For starters, his stronghold is in Aurelia, the mountainous Dark Elf Island in the middle of the Atlantic. Thankfully, we have Dagmar, whose job it is to navigate us there with the aid of Elizabeth's boots."
Dagmar gave one of her subtle nods.
"I know the way, but it's going to be dangerous, especially when we are forced to travel through the unseen kingdoms conquered by the Dark Elves."
"How will we get there?" Joshua asked.
"The Dragonway will take us a good way, but eventually that will end, and we will have to be more resourceful. Aurelia is hundreds of miles from the nearest allied unseen kingdom, so we will either be travelling by sea or air. I've yet to decide. Either way is fraught with peril, especially if we get seen."
"Good. I love peril," Charlie muttered.
"How long will it take you to work out a route?" Ben asked.
Dagmar, not known for her hesitancy, gave it only a moment's thought.
"I can have one mapped in 48 hours.
"Good."
Ben paused and ran a hand through his hair. This responsibility thing wasn't easy.
"To be honest, I doubt I'll be ready by then."
"Why not?"
Natalie asked. Ben tapped a hand on the scabbard.
"Elizabeth's sword. Right now I can barely carry the thing unless it's sheathed. I need to learn to control and harness its magic."
"How do you learn about the sword?"
Abigail asked, her eyes a mixture of innocence and bewilderment.
"I only had the helm, which is far less powerful, and I had Dagmar to help me."
Ben gave a small shrug.
"I'm fairly confident I can master it, but it's going to take a little time, a lot of discipline and considerable willpower. I think it will be like trying to master a grade 10 spell."
"Oh, I didn't know they existed."
Ben smiled.
"They don't."
He turned to Joshua, who was eyeing up his shield, which was placed on his lap.
"I will need your help."
Joshua looked up in surprise.
"Mine?"
"Yes," Ben said, a little more forcefully than he intended.
"You and I are going to be responsible for taking down Suktar, remember? We need to be able to work in perfect harmony. I've seen you with that shield. You're not much better than I am with the sword."
Ben half expected Joshua to complain, but instead he gave a begrudging nod.
"How do you propose we practice? Surely we will need the facilities of the Institute."
"Yes," Ben said, considering the matter. He hadn't thought this far ahead, because he thought Joshua would be more argumentative about the matter. But Joshua could be perfectly reasonable when the situation made sense.
"I can help,"
Charlie piped up suddenly, a chubby arm thrust into the air.
"How?"
Joshua asked.
"I'll set up a regimen for you,"
Charlie said.
"I'm quite good now at casting phantom opponents for you to practice against, and I study the sequence I believe will best help you combat powerful Dark Elf warriors, shamans, and ultimately Dark Elf royalty."
Joshua looked dubious, but Ben leapt at the suggestion, especially as he knew it might alleviate the tension between him and Joshua. We will still need to work out how to get into the Institute without being seen, Joshua said. We had duties, remember, that were basically abandoning.
Leave that to me, Dagmar said.
Ben nodded and turned his attention elsewhere. With some effort, he forced himself to face the dilemma that had played on the back of his mind ever since they recovered the final pieces of armor. He suddenly felt a little sick, but shook the feeling off, clenching his fists. This had to be done, and there was no point delaying it any further.
That just leaves one final issue.
Perhaps the most important, Ben said, looking at everyone around the table.
Who is coming?
I was wondering when you'd get to that, Joshua said, leaning forwards a little on his chair. It is clear to me that the final journey is for guardians and guardians only.
What? No!
Natalie cried out. Somehow, she managed to look both surprised and outraged, even though Ben was almost certain she'd been thinking of little else. Indeed, she had been unusually quiet during the meeting, most likely waiting and planning for this very moment.
This job was always for the guardians, Joshua said, voice softening just a fraction as he turned to Natalie. The simple truth is that we each have very specific roles. Bringing anyone else along could jeopardize those roles and, consequently, the entire mission.
Nonsense,
Natalie said, shaking her head so vigorously some of her soft brown hair flicked into the face of a startled Crowbeg.
You are forgetting about the most important factors in this whole mission. Friendship, loyalty and trust. Without these things, what sort of group are we?
Natalie looked around imploringly, her arms spread, palms up. It was clear then that she had done her homework and researched this very speech, most likely numerous times.
Those are all very important attributes, Crowbeg said.
His face had softened, and Ben could see sympathy lining his craggy face.
But I think in this instance, Joshua might be right. The final journey is for the Guardians, that was clear. I would hate to lose you or Charlie because we didn't realize that.
You won't lose us,
Natalie said, slapping her hands down on the table, making them all jump. Even Dagmar gave a little flinch.
Whatever happens to us is our responsibility.
She turned with some exasperation to Charlie.
Can you help me instead of sitting there like a lemon?
Charlie's face, already a pale shade of red, turned into something resembling a ripe tomato. He attempted to speak, but it took a moment before anything coherent came out, and when it did, Ben could only just about hear it.
We deserve to come with,
Charlie said in a remarkably strained voice. Ben could see his hands were almost white, clenching his chair.
A remarkably convincing argument,
Joshua said with a flicker of a smile.
Especially for one normally so logical. Is that all you can say?
Charlie looked ready to protest, but then, like a balloon, he suddenly deflated and bowed his head for a full minute. When he raised it, there was resignation plastered all over his face.
I can't do this anymore, Charlie said.
He looked at Natalie, his eyes full of sorrow.
I agree with them. As much as I would like to go, and believe me, I would, we've got this far together. It just doesn't make sense, according to everything I've read. The Guardians alone must make this journey. I know we both think we can help, but if anything goes wrong, we're talking about the Dark Elves winning and potentially taking over the seen and unseen kingdoms. I don't think anything is worth such a risk.
There was a sudden silence in the room, broken only by Charlie's breathing as he worked to gather his breath back after his speech. Ben's head was spinning. Half of him was so relieved Charlie had finally revealed his true feelings that he felt like dancing a jig. But any such elation was immediately ruined by the look on Natalie's face. She looked shell-shocked, her green eyes wide but somehow unseeing. Ben could only imagine what was going through her head. He half expected her to explode into Charlie and almost cringed in anticipation of such a move. Instead, she stood up, looking slightly wobbly. In typical fashion, despite the crushing disappointment clearly going through her head, she managed to walk gracefully to the door and out of the room. Nobody moved a muscle until they could hear her footsteps disappearing down the stairs of the Crimson Tower. Charlie was the first to break the silence. His face was pained, and Ben could see beads of sweat running down his ample cheeks.
Oh, no. I really messed that up. Should I go after her?
He half got up, until Ben shook his head vigorously. No. She needs to work this out by herself. It's been coming for a while, anyway. Ben's thoughts immediately went to the incident in Lord Samuel's mansion, where, as non-guardians, they were unceremoniously thrown out of the house. He nodded to himself. Yes, it was the right call, despite the grief it was always going to cause.
That wasn't pleasant, but it had to be done, Joshua said. She'll come round eventually.
Ben nodded absently, slightly annoyed at Joshua's supposed indication that he knew Natalie like they did. If he thought she would shake the whole thing off in a matter of minutes or even hours, he didn't know her at all. Suddenly, Ben was done. He didn't feel like sitting down one more minute and had a sudden urge to get out of the tower. He clearly wasn't the only one. After hastily organizing the next meeting for 24 hours' time, they quickly filed out, each lost in their own world. Within minutes, only Charlie and Ben remained. Ben stood up, glad to be on his feet, and suddenly found he was hungry. He dipped into a couple of sausage rolls.
You did the right thing, he said.
Charlie glanced up, still looking exhausted.
Did I? Natalie's basically going to hate me forever now.
No, she won't. You're being ridiculous, Ben said.
It felt good to eat. He hadn't realized how hungry he was, despite breakfast not long ago, and it calmed his nerves.
She's smart. After a while, she'll realize you made the right choice, or at least the sensible one.
Yeah, sensible, Charlie repeated. Head, not heart, that's me.
Ben threw a sausage at Charlie. If you don't stop beating yourself up, I'm going to hit you. Now, I have another job for you, one that I think could be just as important as the final journey. Charlie's face changed like a flick of a switch, curiosity melting away his self-pity.
What is it? Charlie asked, sitting up. The High Council.
Ben had given the High Council a lot of thought recently, especially after Queen Elizabeth had mentioned them just before his final test to retrieve the sword. He remembered, from what seemed like an age ago, that a wood elf by the name of Lantis had said they were a society of 24 of the most powerful sorcerers, and that Queen Elizabeth had originally got her armor from them. That meant they were powerful. Very powerful, and yet they knew almost nothing about them.
There isn't a lot known about the High Council, Charlie said, breaking Ben's thoughts.
He had stood up and was now pacing slowly, hands behind his back. It was like his upset with Natalie had never happened, so enraptured was he in this new puzzle.
They must have a role to play, Ben said. I feel like it might be important, and I want you to find out what that role is.
Charlie gave an enthusiastic nod.
I can do that. There are a few sections in the library I've recently been granted access to, some really old. I'm sure I can find something.
Good, Ben said. And in the meantime, you're going to help me and Josh learn how to use Elizabeth's armor, and more importantly, stop the two of us killing each other in the process.
Chapter 4. Box Dwarves. Getting into the Institute without being noticed was more difficult than Ben anticipated. As he'd predicted, the place was a madhouse, with Institute members dashing around, rushing to meetings, formulating war plans and trying to manage entire armies from their departments. Ben assumed, because of that, slipping in unnoticed would be a piece of cake. But with everything going on, he had forgotten that he had been assigned to a group of apprentices who were uncommonly good with the spellshooter. It was their duty to guard the Institute from any attacks it might receive. Though that had not yet happened, the apprentice spellswords, led by the spellsword Zadiah, seemed to be everywhere, and Ben had a hell of a time avoiding them.
Dagmar has given us access to a level 3 phantom room, supplied with the spells for exactly the sort of opponents you'll need to master first, Charlie said.
His head bobbed with enthusiasm as he spoke, almost dislodging the books and transcripts under his right arm that he had recently accumulated.
That's great, but how do we get inside? Joshua said impatiently.
He was looking at the Institute entrance with some concern.
We've all got assignments. If we get caught, we're in trouble.
Don't worry about that, Ben said with a dismissive wave. Just make sure you keep your shield hidden, as that will attract attention.
Ben eyed up the Institute entrance one more time. He knew Zadiah currently had his team round the very back of the Institute, studying its architecture, in case any enemy tried scaling the building. They would be there an hour at least, as the Institute had many magical defences to stop people scaling it, and learning them all was no small feat. But there were other problems. Joshua and Charlie were also both part of different teams, and they were inside. If any of those apprentices spotted them, there could be trouble. On top of which, there was always Aaron, who was probably spending the majority of his time wondering where Ben was and if he was doing something that Aaron could nail him for. All in all, Ben thought, getting into the Institute wasn't as straightforward as usual.
"Do you seriously expect to march in and not be seen by the hundreds of members and apprentices?" Joshua asked.
"Something like that," Ben said with a smile. Ben moved before Joshua or Charlie could make any further complaints. The trick was confidence. He made a beeline for the entrance, holding Elizabeth's scabbard close to his leg, so that it wouldn't flap and cause undue attention. It took 60 seconds to stride through the courtyard. Ben, purposefully, kept his eyes on the front door, ignoring the two guards who stood inspecting everyone that passed. He heard Joshua curse, but ignored him. 10 seconds until they were in. They'd done this a million times. Why was his heart pounding so much? 5 seconds. He could see the Institute insignia clearly on the front door. The answer was the sword. If anyone spotted that, he'd be in trouble. With a rush of relief, he passed through. Barely an Institute member or even a guard glanced his way. "That wasn't too bad, was it?" Ben said, giving them both a grin. "Don't know what all the fuss was about."
"We still have to get up to the diplomacy floor," Joshua said, eyeing the chaos around them.
Charlie was also looking anxiously about, and made a sudden movement to conceal himself behind Ben.
"That's Crane Lodestone. He thinks I'm working full-time on Dark Elf Rider patterns."
"Let's get a move on," Ben said. Ben headed swiftly up the stairs, with a confidence that left no members in any doubt that he belonged there. Joshua and Charlie followed right behind, with slightly less swagger. Room 4, Ben said to himself. He smiled briefly at the spell swords passing by, but few paid him any heed, which suited him just fine. Nevertheless, he sighed with relief the moment he pulled out the key and entered the Phantom Room, and then locked it from the inside.
"Walking up here hasn't been so daunting since the first spellshifter test," Charlie said, wiping his brow.
Ben surveyed the room, and was pleased to see it was one of the more equipped Phantom Rooms, designed for the single purpose of training apprentices against specific types of opponents, in this case, dark magic-based unseens. The room was a good size, with an elevated boxing ring in the centre, complete with a soft floor and ropes. On one side of the room were all sorts of weapons, from short swords to 6-foot halberds. On the opposite side were rows of compartments filled with spells of each element. There was even a metallic framework, complete with wooden planks near the ceiling, to cater for simulated combat above ground.
"So, what's the plan?"
Ben asked, rubbing his hands together eagerly. Charlie put his documents down in the corner.
"Realistically, I think it's going to take 7 days for you to be competent enough to use your pieces of armour, if we can do at least 5 hours a day in here."
7 days, Joshua said. "Do we have that much time?"
7 days would be good going, Charlie said sternly. "Even then, you'll have to keep practising several hours a day on your journey."
7 days will be fine, Ben assured him, though he kept his anxiety to himself. The idea that they wouldn't be ready to leave until the war was 7 days old sent a shiver up his spine.
"So, where do we start?"
Charlie picked up an old leather-bound book, the cover of which was almost completely ruined, and expertly thumbed to the back.
"This book was written only 22 years after Queen Elizabeth died, by one of her healers, who may have been present at key times in her life. Of course, this person could be talking a load of nonsense and just trying to sell his book, but there was some useful information in here, especially if he was that close to her."
Ben listened with rapt attention. Even Joshua appeared captivated. Charlie reminded him of a teacher, and thought again how suited he would be to the scholar department.
"The very first step, as you're probably aware, Ben, is to be able to hold your piece of Elizabeth's armour comfortably, without having a heart attack."
"Yeah, he has a problem with that," Joshua said with a small smile. "I'd like to see you hold this thing," Ben said, tapping the scabbard. "It's like trying to hold a nuclear missile that's going off."
"Well, you're going to have to hold it if you want to take out Suktar," Charlie said. and Joshua will have to be equally comfortable defending with his shield to give you time for that killer blow. So, that's where we'll start.
Okay, Ben said, eyeing the scabbard and the sword warily. His hands hovered over them, and he felt the scabbard, but he was loath to put his hand on the blade, knowing full well what happened last time.
Slow down, Charlie said, holding a hand out, his face a picture of alarm. You weren't thinking of drawing the sword, were you?
Maybe, Ben said a little uncertainly.
Shouldn't I be?
Oh, no, Charlie said, shaking his head vigorously.
You're not ready, not nearly ready.
He turned to Joshua. That goes for you as well. Yes, you can touch it, but you can't use it. I don't want to see you interacting with your armour until I say so.
Ben was afraid Joshua might take offence to Charlie's authoritative manner, but found to his surprise that Joshua instead gave a small smile. Charlie turned back to his small leather book and started trailing a finger through it.
The sword and the shield differ from the other pieces of armour in several ways. They possess higher levels of magic, they are harder to control, and they respond differently.
Charlie looked up at both of them, but according to this book, there is one difference more important than all the others.
And that is?
They have a low-level sentience. Ben frowned.
You mean they are alive?
They can think.
According to this book, yes, Charlie said.
Of course, this book could all be absolute nonsense, in which case I'll promptly hack the thing to pieces and throw it in the bin. But I'm going to operate on the basis that it's somewhat accurate. It gives us a good starting point.
And what starting point is that? Joshua asked, now looking at Charlie with genuine curiosity.
We need to get you able to communicate, eventually, telepathically, to a low-level consciousness, Charlie said.
I was just about to say the same thing, Ben said, looking slightly bemused and running a hand through his hair. I assume you have some sort of plan.
Much like you always do, Charlie said, grinning. The plan is box dwarves.
Box dwarves?
Joshua frowned.
Are we talking about literally getting dwarves in the ring and going for a round of boxing or something else?
Something else, Charlie said. Box dwarves have the honour of being one of the least intelligent races in the Unseen Kingdoms. I would put them just ahead of the monkey.
That's strange. Dwarves aren't normally that dumb, Ben said.
These are an anomaly, Charlie said. You'll see what I mean when I summon them.
So what are we supposed to do?
Fight them?
Joshua asked, glancing at one of the many weapons on the shelves.
You could choose a weapon for self-defence, but that's not the point, and frankly, I doubt they could hurt you if they tried, Charlie said.
Your job is to get inside their head and communicate to them. Ultimately, you should be able to command the box dwarves around the ring. Gaining that ability is the first step you'll need to being able to master your pieces of armour.
Makes sense, Ben nodded. Let's try it.
Both Joshua and Ben grabbed a short sword, ducked beneath the ropes, and hopped into the boxing ring. Charlie went over to the shelves full of spells and picked out a blue one before inserting it into his spell shooter.
I'm going to cast just one at first, Charlie said. He may or may not have a weapon, but even if he comes fully suited with plate mail and sword, I doubt he'd be able to touch you, so don't worry about getting hurt.
Ben had questions, but before he had the chance to voice them, Charlie raised his spell shooter and fired into the centre of the boxing ring. The spell hit the floor with a soft puff of smoke, which rapidly rose, until Ben could make out a short, stubby form. Within moments, it had solidified, leaving a small, rather rotund dwarf staring stupidly into space, clearly wondering what he was doing here. Ben immediately realised why Charlie had referred to the box dwarf as one of the least intelligent races in the Unseen Kingdoms. His eyes were dull and his mouth was half open, threatening to drool some peculiar coloured saliva onto the floor. He kept blinking, as if trying to register the environment he was in. It took him several moments to realise that he bore a club with a knobbly end, and several more to spot Ben and Joshua. Slowly, the dwarf moved forwards towards Joshua. Joshua instinctively raised his sword. He didn't look scared exactly, but he was frowning with concern.
What do I do? Don't kill it for starters, Charlie said. That would defeat the whole purpose. We're supposed to be practicing with it.
The box dwarf eventually reached Joshua and swung his club, almost in slow motion.
Joshua blocked it with ease, and then moved back into the centre. The box dwarf turned slowly, like a truck with a particularly poor turning circle.
"Okay, Ben, your first objective is to make it stop," Charlie said. "Joshua, you let it keep on following you around, while you, Ben, try to communicate with it telepathically."
"That's not really my strong point," Ben admitted.
"Just direct your attention on the dwarf and infuse your thoughts into it," Charlie said, now sifting through another book. "A lot of it is about willpower and intention, which you're exceptionally good at."
Ben nodded. With Joshua, the subject of the box dwarf's interest, focusing was a lot easier. He thought about the countless times he'd commanded his spell shooter, sometimes firing spells that required huge amounts of willpower, focus and vision. Surely this couldn't be more difficult than that. But he'd never reached inside someone's head before. Ben went for the spell shooter routine. He was familiar with it, and it felt less awkward. He focused on the box dwarf, who was currently taking a clumsy swipe at Joshua. Ben envisioned the dwarf stopping, and, with a thought that harbored no reservation, sent it right at the box dwarf. Nothing happened.
"Did you even send the communication?" Joshua asked.
"Course I did. But clearly it didn't get through the dwarf's thick skull."
"Granted, his skull does look thick," Joshua admitted with a small smile. "Try again," Charlie said, undeterred. "It may take several goes for it to truly impinge."
Ben tried again. Nothing. Not even a flinch. Several more attempts yielded similar results. He clenched his fists and tried ramming the thought down the dwarf's throat.
"Don't do that," Charlie said, noticing Ben's tensed expression. "It's just like the spell shooter. If you let anger get in the way, it'll never work."
"With or without anger, it's not working," Ben said.
"Are you sure about this?"
"Yes," Charlie said emphatically. "Just keep trying. It's like anything. It takes practice. You can't just expect to get it first go."
"No. Ben normally takes at least two or three goes before he gets it, don't you, Ben?" Joshua said.
Ben wasn't sure if that was a compliment or a thinly barbed insult, but he ignored it and redoubled his efforts. Ben spent a moment collecting himself. "This shouldn't be that difficult," he thought. He took a deep breath, cleared his mind, and then sent another thought, this one much softer, cleaner, but with just as much intention. It was a simple order to get the box dwarf moving.
"There you go,"
Charlie said, with a clap of the hands and a pump of the fist. Ben grinned with delight. The box dwarf hesitated for about 5 seconds before resuming his amble towards Joshua. It took Ben several more attempts to repeat the feat. He soon noticed the dampness on his forehead. But after almost an hour of toiling, he was able to stop and start the box dwarf at will.
"Good," Charlie said, looking so pleased it made one wonder if he had achieved the feat himself. "Now we switch. Joshua, you're up."
Joshua attacked the task with a resolute determination, as if his primary goal was to finish it before Ben had. Time and again, he focused on the box dwarf, willing it to stop moving. However, Ben had the advantage of greater experience and aptitude in firing the spell shooter, which wasn't hugely different from stopping the dwarf. Joshua was still trying to get the dwarf to stop by the time Ben had been able to hold it still for a good 10 seconds.
"I think you broke the dwarf,"
Joshua said, giving Ben an accusing glance. Ben gave a shrug and a smile, but resisted the urge to reply.
"Summon another one," Joshua said, turning his attention to Charlie. "I really don't think that's the issue here."
"It might be," Joshua said stubbornly,
"and it can't hurt, can it?"
Charlie gave an exaggerated sigh. He shot at the box dwarf, who promptly disappeared in a flash of red smoke, and then fired another one. It looked identical to the last, and in wonderful slow motion, headed towards Ben, club raised. Ben could see Joshua firing a thought at it as soon as it had formed. If anything, the dwarf sped up a little.
"What am I doing wrong?"
Joshua said, raising his arms and looking at Charlie with exasperation. Charlie raised a hand.
"First of all, you're losing your cool. You're not going to move a pebble like that. Take a break for 5 minutes.
Joshua paced around the ring, looking up at Charlie every 30 seconds to check whether 5 minutes had elapsed.
"We're going to wait here all day until you calm down," Charlie said.
"Stop pacing and just relax. Joshua gave Charlie an accusing frown. With some effort, he stopped pacing and attempted several more deep breaths. To Ben's surprise, he kept at it until the frustrated frown left his face, revealing a calmness that he hadn't shown since he'd first attempted to stop the dwarf. "Okay, whenever you're ready," Charlie said softly. Ben watched the box dwarf closely as it approached. Nothing happened. Joshua, unperturbed, showed no sign of annoyance. Ben was about to lift his sword for the umpteenth time when the dwarf opened its mouth and paused a second. It lasted just a moment before it swung its club.
"Yes!"
Charlie shouted, completely ruining Joshua's concentration. Joshua opened his eyes, pure delight on his face.
"Did I do it?"
"You did it," Ben said with a grin. Within another half an hour, Joshua had the box dwarf stopping and starting just like Ben. Charlie clapped enthusiastically.
"Good work, guys. Let's take a break."
Ben looked up at Joshua, and they gave each other a mutual nod of acknowledgement. Chapter 5. It Takes Practice. The next few days saw Ben and Joshua really dive into their training without actually touching their respective sword and shield. They mastered the complete maneuverability of the box dwarf before progressing through the grey goblin and then the dazed pixie. Charlie spent most of his time with them, but there were periods when he went off to research the High Council, leaving Joshua and Ben alone to progress with their training. The war in London was constantly on the back of Ben's mind. After the initial surprise sprung by the Dark Elves, the Institute's army had evened things up, and Prince Robert, along with the diplomacy director, had finally managed to brief the government on the situation. Part of Ben wished he were there, but he knew his purpose lay here, learning to use the sword. Then there was Natalie. Ben hadn't seen her since she had left the meeting in the Crimson Tower. He and Charlie searched every day, but without success.
"You think she's done something silly?"
Charlie asked one morning after they'd once again managed to successfully sneak into the training room.
"No, she's too smart for that," Ben said. "She's just very upset, and she's also very stubborn. I'm sure she's avoiding us on purpose, but she'll show herself eventually."
"I keep going over in my head how I could have avoided this catastrophe," Charlie said, running a hand over his cheeks.
Ben looked at him firmly. "Don't go there again. You did the right thing. Now we have to face the consequences." Nevertheless, Ben worried and thought about Natalie every day. But he was also so busy that it never lingered too long before he was back training.
"I think you're almost ready," Charlie said, rubbing his hands.
Ben and Joshua had just dismissed a sea dwarf, using their combined thoughts to control it. They had both pulled up chairs in the ring and were listening to Charlie with rapt attention.
"Ready to use Elizabeth's weapons?" Ben asked.
"If by use you mean touch and hold, then yes," Charlie said.
Ben couldn't help giving a little sigh of relief. It was now the fifth day since they had started training, and he was eager to get going on the final journey, something that could only happen once they could actually use the weapons they intended to end Saktar's life with.
"Joshua, go pick up your shield," Charlie said.
Joshua didn't need asking twice. He ducked under the ring and walked over to his shield. Slowly, with two hands, he picked up the shield, and his eyes immediately widened.
"I can feel its magic," he whispered, "far more than before the training."
He turned to Charlie and gave an approving nod.
"Your training has really helped."
"Thanks," Charlie said, unable to hide his pleasure. "But we've barely started. The sword and the shield are sentient, remember? In fact, their consciousness is not that far below a human's, according to several articles I've read. Your task is to work with the artifact and gain its willingness for you to harness its power."
"And how do we do that?" Joshua asked. "By using similar principles to the lower-level opponents you've been facing," Charlie said. He thrust a finger in the air. "But there is one big difference. With Elizabeth's armor, you do not force or command it. You contact it and convince it to lend its magic to you. Only then will you be able to harness the magic."
If learning to master the box dwarf was difficult, that was nothing compared to what Charlie was now asking. For an hour, Joshua held the shield in all sorts of positions, staring at it, clearly